So I was doing a walking meditation just now outside on the sidewalk. And at some point I lifted my head as I was walking and I saw three cars coming down the road, and one of them was a convertible. And it was really funny to see the conditioned response to seeing the convertible. There was four people in there. And there was right then and there, there was a sense of there was a clinging. Like there was three or four cars, three ordinary car, non-desirable cars, and one car that was promising satisfaction. It was very funny. I just looked, and it was a conditioned response, you know, like I probably was exposed to many images of happy people in convertibles. It seemed like happiness was in that car, you know. It took just a second. It was like this, and there was this this claim. It was not intense, you know. I didn't like rush forward or anything, but there was just this suddenly stood out. That car stood out. The other I didn't care at all about. They were kind of neutral cars, recognized, period. But this one was like, happiness is in there. And but there was mindfulness there, you know. And it brought joy because that was the seeing of the teachings in action, you know, how, and this is conditioned, you know, like, as I said, was probably exposed to, but I know better. I know that you can really be miserable in a convertible also. It's not the convertible that makes the freedom happen. It's not the fact that there's a, what is it? Not a hood, but yeah. So yesterday we were talking about this. That was the first kind of group of pleasantness and unpleasantness and how we can be hooked. Our views, you know, that's the second aspect of clinging. This view, there was this wrong view for a second in my mind that happiness is inconvertible. You know, it's not in the state of the heart mind that is free, you know. And then I came back to this body, which is pretty miserable. So I came back to this body. I was like, yeah, it's true. In this body, it's not so fun, you know. It's the head is a little like cement and it's achy. And but then there was acceptance and confidence that this mind can be with this uncomfortable body. And then there was a sense of some kind of freedom in there that, oh, I don't need the body to feel differently, you know. It can be, you know, tight and hard and all this, and but there's no or very little reactivity in the mind at this point. And I thought, oh, that is a deeper sense of well-being, you know, the capacity to be with things as they are showing up right now. So that was fun to notice this. This the confidence here. Oh yeah, I can be with that. All these different things that are happening to this body right now. So, pleasantness and unpleasantness. I remember, I tell this story sometimes, I was on retreat, and you'll think like, what's this guy teaching us? He's crazy, and we're considering his ideas. But I was on retreat, and I was sitting on my cushions, supposedly being attentive. But actually, I was lost in thoughts. And I was thinking, because I was going from retreat center to retreat center, and I didn't have a home, and not a car also. And this idea came to my mind, oh, I should get a car and live in my car. It would make it easy for me to go from one place to the other. And the idea was very pleasant, to own a car and live in the car. And I could see myself driving from East Coast to West Coast, you know, and even the car breaking down was pleasant, you know, because I would stop in this kind of lust in the desert, you know, garage, and I would wait outside while the old man was fixing my, and we would have a very deep conversation with the old mechanic, and I was going on like this, and at some point I noticed, you know, like first that I was dreaming, but what appeared to me very clearly is that everything that my my mind was fantasizing, creating at all the same feeling tone of it, of being pleasant, you know? So, and then I thought a little bit more, and I thought, wow, living in a car, you know, like, it's not so comfortable. You know, there's no shower, the bed is not so long, you know, it's just the back seat, you know, and suddenly, like, it came back, oh, so that's kind of the nature of fantasy. It presents to me a world of pleasantness, you know, it promises a world where, but it's not, reality is not exactly like that, you know? And so that's how we can get, I mean, I'm sure you know, I'm the only one who had that fantasy that was so pleasant, but... And so sometimes we can also, when we're thinking about the future, a lot of the time, and notice for yourself if it's true, that there's projection of desire, of possible pleasant, or projection of possible unpleasant. So we'll be in fear of the future. I'll die alone, and I'll be miserable, and, you know, and it's all unpleasant. It's our relationship to unpleasant that makes this projection. And the opposite for the pleasurable. This is what I want in the futuring that I do is often related to pleasant or unpleasant. Thousands of years ago, there was this practitioner that was very, very respected, Damadina. And she had a conversation that is famous, conversation with her ex-husband. She had become a nun practicing. And she was very, very respected as a teacher. And so they met, and he asked her, say, tell me something about pleasantness and unpleasantness. There's a whole conversation, but in that little bit, he says, tell me a little something about pleasantness and unpleasantness. And she says, pleasant, when it finishes, it's unpleasant. And unpleasant, when it finishes, it's pleasant. And I mean, it looks like nothing, but when you consider it deeply, it's, I mean, one contains the other. That's kind of one conclusion one could have from that, you know. And then she said something more. She said, if I report her words well, is the neutral, when met without knowledge, tends to lead to unpleasantness. But when met with knowledge, can be known as pleasant. And that, to me, the way I've seen this come true, maybe, is the breath, for example, might feel very neutral to you. You're not like madly in love with the breath or hate the breath. You know, it's just something that happens in the body. But if there's little attention or an attention that is intermittent or scattered, you know, like not sustained, it can easily seem boring. Like, what's this thing about the breath and this meditation? And it's unpleasant. But if the attention becomes settled and has some depth to it, suddenly the breath might become very rich and in all sorts of ways, as a refuge to abide in, as a place to discover what it is to have a body, you know, and the richness of it. Suddenly it can become as a tone of pleasantness to it because of the curiosity and the presence in the mind. So I don't know if that's what she meant, but that's interesting. The tendency that is usually activated with the neutral feeling tone that comes with events is that we miss it. There's delusion. Like when I lifted my eyes and there was four cars and I saw only the one that had a promise of happiness in it. The three others were like very quickly dismissed. I knew there was three, but that was the extent of it, you know. And so in our life, we are often like this, we'll miss some people because they're not outstanding in terms of promising happiness, or they're not friends or foe, you know, so we might not see that they exist, or because there's a neutrality about it. And sometimes in the practice, people will report like, I don't know what to do, like there's nothing happening. And so it's a sign that the mindfulness maybe has not the depth enough yet, you know. or that the neutrality is missed somehow. And even there can be sometimes peace, like almost available, but we'll miss it because it has a neutral feeling to it, you know. It's not the only kind of peace that can be there, but we say we want peace, but sometimes I think, peace is for the more heroic people who can actually feel, be okay with neutrality, you know, and sustain attention to something that is not so outstanding, maybe. Few thoughts anyway on this. So I want to move on. I wish I could, I'll be able to move on because we have four of these to look at. And so we look at views, huh? The views that we cling to, sometimes without knowing. So the view of satisfaction, that this will satisfy me deeply forever, is a wrong view. Nothing that is conditioned, that comes because of something else, can provide deep, lasting satisfaction. It's not possible. That's the teaching, so it's for us to verify. I can't remember which one of the wise, numerous beings that I had the chance to encounter or read, or I think it's Ajahn Sumedho or Suchito who says, if you want to suffer, invest in something, invest your happiness in something that begins. Because something that begins, yeah. So, I mean, that's something we do commonly, to invest a lot in something that begins, you know. And it's also pointing to the Nibbana, the unconditioned, the unborn, undying, this other thing. I don't know if it's a thing, but this, just want to bring this back here. There's something that is not born, does not die, is not formed of something else, that is apparently available. What is that? Some describe it as the absence of reactivity. So the absence of reactivity. Can we touch that, know that? So the third, so pleasant, being attached or clinging to pleasantness, clinging to views and opinion, especially of the wrong, the unwise kind. And then the third aspect is classically is known as clinging to rites and rituals. So in there, in my thinking about it, I put a lot of stuff in there. So rites and rituals, ways to do things. You know, we can cling to this, you know. The door of the bathroom should always be closed when there's nobody in it. I mean, one can make themselves miserable over this ritual of closing the door. It's just a little example to show where we can attach to a certain way of doing things. An area that I find interesting to begin to think about or bring in there is the area of norming, and how we can become attached to norms. Yeah? Like the example that I cited yesterday about the waterfalls and how clinging to norms can cause a lot of suffering to others. So that, in that example, was that two men shouldn't be in love together, you know, that this is not in the norm and will remind you. Yeah. At some point I was reading a small article from Rita Gross, who's a Buddhist thinker, and she was saying there was just this paragraph, and she was saying, this being, her, clearly has a female body. There's no doubt about this. And But because there is this female body, it doesn't mean that this being has had children, has been able to have children, has ever wanted children. It doesn't mean because of this form that this being is attracted to that other kind of being, or that this being has those qualities, you know, or those interests. But because of this female body, people assume all the time, and sometimes they're wrong and sometimes they're right, that this is what comes with that form, you know, all these things, having had children or being having those qualities, and sometimes being gently reminded of the qualities that comes with this form, or should, you know, or not so gently reminded, you know, of, and so that's a kind of norming there that, and to me it's very, I mean, it's very wide. Like in there, we have like racism, ageism, sexism, you know, and all the, and how, in my clinging to some views, I can create unsafety or lack of protection or freedom for somebody, yeah. And how those other people clinging to their to some norms can make the world oppressive for me, or so how I can oppress or be oppressed by norms, you know, and the recognition of that, bringing some clarity to this, becoming awake to that, bringing consciousness to that. So that's a whole field. I'll say just these few words on that. There's an other area that of conventions, so rites, rituals, ways to do things, norms, conventions. I'll just bring this little example. I have these little snippets of something, but it might help you think of something in your life that is... So the ritual or convention of Valentine that we have had a few months ago. So for some people, let's say there's a partnership there, and one half of the partnership hold that as a very precious, very beautiful ritual. And they cling to that idea that is it's an important ritual. And the other half of the partnership think that this is a money-making thing. And they cling to that view of the ritual, you know. And so for me, the interesting thing in practice is, so how can we, in that case, for example, enter this gracefully so that I can release some of the clinging, keep maybe the view or the that I have about the ritual, whichever side of the fence I fall on, you know. But how can I enter the world of conventions that are different for different people in a graceful manner with the consciousness? Yeah. So that's just one little example. But so another example around the convention is one day I was on retreat, and there was a small group discussions like we had here. And in my group discussion, there was a man who said, I own a restaurant, and every few weeks or months, somebody who comes and does a graffiti on the wall and window of my restaurant. And that really pisses me off, because it's my restaurant, and it's against the law to do graffitis. So what am I supposed to do with that, you know? Asking the teacher was there, and the teacher said, well, you know, maybe you have to... look at your, or correct your understanding of conventional reality and ultimate reality. Two realities coexisting together. And if you get them mixed up, there's suffering that results into this. So, on a conventional reality level, it's really your restaurant, there's no doubt about that. You know? On the ultimate level, it's not your restaurant. It's not possible to own a wall, you know. Really, at the conventional level, yeah, because you go to the notary or lawyer and everybody signs paper and we all agree this is your cement, you know, and glass, it's yours. But ultimately, with wisdom, we can understand that it's not possible to own something material. Yeah? And so that somebody can break this understanding because it's only conventional. It works as long as we agree that it's yours. Somebody doesn't agree. Yeah? When I was doing, in my last life, I was doing a lot of theater. And this is something that from childhood, and probably one of the reasons why I went in that field, is I loved the conventions of theater. So, you know, let's agree that you're my sister. And everybody, like, when I come in on stage, I'm like, hey, sister. And everybody's like, oh, it's his sister. Let's agree. You know, okay, it's your sister. And so that's the beauty of it, is we all agree that you're my sister. And then we have a fight about it. And then at the end of the play, you know, we all go home, you know. But, you know, if you were to call me home and say, hey, brother, I would say, like, hey. That was just from 7 to 7:30, you know. Like, that was the agreement we had during that time, you know. But only on stage, you know, and it's beautiful. And a lot of the joy I got from the theater over the years, and it's still there, it's the world of convention, because, you know, I just remember somebody comes on stage, and they do like this, and they do like that. And the 900 of us, or 150 of us, oh, he just opened and closed the door, you know. But there's no door there, but we all agreed, you know. There's an opening and a closing, and if somebody, the next person comes, they open the door, they close the door. The next person comes, they open the door, and if it's a good play and they play well with convention, somebody will come, open the door, and go in, and then the mom will say, close the doors, and they'll go back and pretend they're closing the door. And if one of the actors comes in like this, we'll go like, what is he doing, or what is she doing? You know, the door. Don't you know there's a door there? So there's a conventional level there. Well, it applies in life, too. There are conventions, you know, like laws are conventions that we agree on, you know. Okay, we'll all drive on the right side here. And somewhere else they say, oh, we'll all drive on the left side, you know. And we agree on this. So it's important to understand the conventional level of reality. And this fourth aspect that I've moved to is really much related to this with the my and, you know, it's my bike. Well, you know, somebody else takes it and goes away with it. You know? And of course I can be angry like the guy at the restaurant, you know. It fits at the conventional level, of course you would be angry. But here we're looking for an unconditional freedom. Unconventional freedom. And this is the beauty of it, so that we can bring that aspect back. And a lot of our practice, I think, is to balance these two realities that coexist. And we've fallen in our life like too much, too deep into the conventional reality, so much so that we really think, but it is my husband, it is my kid, you know? Well, yes and no, you know? So that's the conventional. So again, I'm just kind of throwing this there for your further reflection or continued reflection about this. And where do you get stuck on in there about the conventions? Oh, this being said, then maybe that's important to conclude with this. There was another very wise being. I think it's Shantideva, Tibetan master, who said, although my view is vast as the sky, my attention to detail is fine as a grain or particle of barley flour. And if I bring this to the world of convention, there it's like, although I know that nothing's belong to anyone and on the ultimate level, my respect of convention is very, very precise. I understand conventions, and I know which one I want to go by and which one I want to break, or norms, you know. I'm awake to that. This is how I understand it. I find beautiful. So there's an understanding that is very, very wide, but a detail, oh, you know, in ultimate reality, it doesn't really belong to you, so let me take it. No, there is a conventional reality. It's completely there. And so, so the fourth aspect is the me, mine, I aspect, where there can be a, it can be very gross, the suffering and the identification that comes with that, and it can be extremely subtle also. So just one, or rather four ways to consider this. So first I'll say, sorry, this area there is kind of almost counterintuitive. That's how it's presented sometimes. Partly the deepest teachings of Buddhism there, very central. It says that this clinging to things as I, mine, or when this is clarified deeply, if we clarify that area of our life deeply, then the result is freedom. So there's four ways that one can either appropriate. Yeah, thanks. Group effort again. Appropriate or identify with or own or get mixed up in there about conventions and ultimate reality, but in the very field of owning and being. And so it says that you either think that something, some event, some process, something is me. This is me. This body is me. This emotion that I feel is me. This is me. Or this sense of humor is me. Or whatever it is, it's me. It's either me or mine. No, Pascal, the body is not me. I understand that. I have some depth of wisdom. But it certainly is mine. You know, it feels like mine. Mine. Yeah? And you might recognize it, but that's really how I feel. Fine, very, very good. It's good to recognize that, oh, it's perceived very much like this. And so in Buddhism, we go as far as questioning even that that seems so real and so it's a given. This is something you wouldn't even question. What is he saying? Of course it's my body. Yeah. Well, we question this. In Buddhism, it's a very interesting thing to explore. So it's either me or mine, or I'm in it. It's not my body, but I'm in it, Pascal. Clearly. Yeah? Or I'm in it, or it's inside of me. I'm not the emotions. They come and go, you know, anger, joy, boredom. They're not me, but they're inside of me. So apparently there wouldn't be any other ways to kind of appropriate, identify with, own. You know? And so these four ways would be considered, unless they're considered at the level of conventions and really recognized as such as at the level of convention for talking, for understanding each other. But at the ultimate level, if I really believe this, then there is either suffering now or there will be at the moment of change in that thing that will change. So, yesterday I was talking about health. And for me, when I was 25, there was this, I was identified with health. There was no health is there, health is impermanent, conditional, you know. There was a complete, there was nothing apart, you know, Pascal was health. So there was a big crisis there because it was suddenly was not true anymore. And so who was I then, you know? So that's one example. I mean, there's several because our lives are made of these examples of I-ing and my-ing and I'm in and it's in me. Another one that happens, and again, no judgment about this. We just want to become conscious of it, maybe intrigued by it or feel the pain of it if it's true for us. But if I'm identified with, let's say, a function, something that I do, yeah, like I am, let's say, I am an actor, but nobody has called me in 5 years, then, you know, it's like, oh, you know, acting is something that one does, you know, like, so if there's an identification with this, mothering also is, no, I'm not sure about that, you'll tell me, but, so there might be at some point a crisis because I'm a mother, but I'm not anymore, or I'm not right now, or like, who am I if I, you know? I remember from my mom when me and my brother, the same year we left home, there was vertigo there, you know, because she had defined herself, of course, you know, around these two very needy, demanding, exploitative beings, you know. And there was, you know, took a few years, I think, before there was a, you know, discovering, making up another kind of self also, you know. I don't know if I talk about this enough respectfully and with also with any kind of knowledge, but anyway, just to throw it there, you know. So identification with the function. One thing that is very, to clarify this, you know, at many levels can be very freeing. So in this practice, one thing that I've observed us do is that we can be very identified with emotions. And at some point, we loosen the identification. It's not me, the frightened being. I've always been fearful, or I'm angry. I'm an angry person. Anger is present. There's anger. It's not that it disappeared necessarily, but there's not the identification. It's clearly there. But it's not me, but it's there. Yeah? This can be very freeing. And this is what I consider also being the middle path between the extremes of, let's say, one extreme would be guilt. It's really me. I'm guilty of having this emotion or these thoughts, you know. And the other extreme would be responsibility. You know, I have these potentially dangerous emotion come up and I'm irresponsible. I act on it, you know. And the middle path is like, oh, there's anger here. Better be aware, because anger usually, you know, remove the nuances. Things become black and white. I'm right, you're wrong. I'm good, you're bad. You know, it can blur vision, you know. So no guilt, no irresponsibility, middle path. What's here right now? There is anger. It's present. Same thing with generosity. Generosity is present. If there is a kind of a wrong understanding and owning, I'm so generous. Always been. I'm a generous guy. You know? Do you see the perversion there? There's an owning. It's not necessary. One can recognize the presence of generosity. It's beautiful, this wish to share or to connect. You know, it's wholesome. It's beautiful. I can recognize that and act on it. You know. So that's what I call the middle path. Not owning, but being responsible about what's arising in the mind. Same thing with the thought. If suddenly a really ugly thought crosses this mind, and I take it personal, I'm such a bad person to think that. Is that helpful? To me, what seems helpful is to recognize, oh, this thought is not to be followed, not to be encouraged, not to be extrapolated on, you know, it's to be abandoned, you know. I think it makes life very, very simple in a way, you know. Maybe ideas that are hard to consider because we've been so much in this world of me, mine, I. But in a way, it becomes a very simple practice. The way I think about it sometimes is what energy is driving what's the expression? Is it the expression again? Driving the show or leading or driving? There must be a right word. Anyway, so because with there's always some quality that is there. Generosity, confusion, payback, desire to understand. And the job to me with this being aware and conscious, more and more conscious, is to know what qualities are at the forefront, from what quality will arise intention, speech, action, you know, to know that. I remember talking to a young person and they were saying, like, sometimes I'm like this and I'm this kind of agitated person and sometimes I'm like this really calm person. Which one am I, Pascal? Well, in Buddhism, we just drop the question. It's not very important. It's what energy is there and do you want to feed it or do you want to abandon it, you know? Do you want to... That's the only question that is really relevant, yeah? So, emotions, thoughts... And it's not like they disappear, they're really there, you know. But there's not the identification with it, or body sensations, really there. And some areas of where it usually, like the last kind of, I think you call it strongholds of identification, can be intention. Ooh, that's a whole other field, you know. Okay, not my emotion, not my thoughts, not my body, okay, but I'm the one who goes to do the walking, you know, and to come. I'm the one who sits down when it's time for the talk or the sit. I intend, you know, that it's me doing the moving, you know, the reaching for the cup. This is me, you know, or mind, or I'm in it, or it's in me. Yeah. And when the mind calms down, and that is the kind of thing that maybe can be clarified only through meditation, not through the first level of information, ideas, maybe not even through the second level of reflection, but through the third level of directly experiencing with a calm and focused mind, which we call meditation. Where, and that's, I'll give you a few examples of where it can become apparent. So I go to do walking meditation. And let's say I do it, imagine I would do it in the room just here. And the room is clear, there's just this path here and I walk back and forth. It's very interesting that the idea of turning back, turning on the other direction arises just before I hit the wall. You know? So we say intention is conditional. It's conditioned. Even the idea of doing walking meditation, if it was not taught, and if you were not invited to go somewhere in the parking lot, walk back and forth for 30 minutes, would that really arise in your mind, ever? You know, that idea of like, oh, I'll go do walking meditation is conditional to a bunch of things. Having heard about it, being invited to do it, about to hit the wall is the time, or the tree is the time where I have the sudden idea that I could turn, you know? Or, you know, if you have, you'll try this one day at home, in the moment where you're hungry, if you ever get there in your life sometimes, if you're hungry and you put a fork in your hand with some food on it, broccoli or something you like. So just stay there. If the conditions are there, like hunger, fork, with food on it, the intention to bring the fork to the mouth is very likely to arise in your mind. And you might think this is me, you know, doing this with the fork, you know. But in a very a mind that is very attentive will see that, wow, intention to move the fork arises. If we have an ordinary mind, which is really fine to accomplish a lot of things in life, it's going to be very obvious that it's me moving the fork, you know. And we live at that level of reality. But if we calm down a bit, my sense is it's going to become very apparent that, for example, why do I have the idea of making this phone call? Well, who's driving the show? You know, some sense of revenge, so I'll generously give some feedback to somebody, you know. Some sense of wanting to understand and connect, or, you know. And so I'll make the phone call and say, hey, how are you? What's going on between us? Or what happened this afternoon, you know. And so the intention is born of some kind of emotion that is there, you know. So some kind of state of mind that is there. So that's one place where we could really think, but it's me intending. And that's what I find fascinating, is that in a regular life, I really have this feeling, oh, no, it's me, it's me. So I can become aware of that. Oh, it appears like this. It's amazing how we perceive things is not necessarily reality. Even though it feels very much like it, it's very three-dimensional, it's felt, but it's me, you know? It's just one perception of a reality, one level that is matched with the level of attention, the level of match with the conditioning. I've been told that. But if I drop a bit, and that can be very liberating to see this, that things arise from conditions. Yeah? Intentions are conditional, yeah, always. Intention in and of itself, it says that it's neutral. It's just the energy to think, act, speak. You know, it's behind any movement. As you move your arm, if you want to do this now, this intention is constantly there, otherwise the arm would stop. In and of itself, it's neutral. But if it's colored by greed, or if it's colored by generosity, you know, it'll make the hand move in a different way, you could say. And we can check that in life. And sometimes we have mixed intentions. Or we do something with some clarity about our intention, and on the other side of the action of the words, we're like, oh, it's been revealed that the intention was different than what I thought, you know. There was some secret state of mind finding their way there, you know. And so, and the last kind of stronghold of identification will be what we talked about earlier, this knowing quality of mind, the consciousness, like the knower or the observer. This is me. You know, okay, you convinced me. Everything else is not really me. But the knowing is me. And so see if it feels like this now or in meditation, you know, the knowing is really me or mine, or I'm in it, or it's in me, or any version of it, you know, and at some point it might appear differently, that knowing is a kind of a given. I don't choose it. I happen to be, you know, a feet there, and there happens to be knowing also that is flowing, you know, and that is present. With this idea of me, with this idea of me and I, comes a sense of separation. So there's me and there's the world. And it's viable, but it's going to take a lot of strategizing and protecting and controlling and fearing and, you know. And that's the stress we talk about in Buddhism. So here, trying to find a me without a world that burdens it is like trying to run away from your own shadow. No matter how fast you run, the effort is bound to fail as the one form generates the other. With the me form is generated the form of other world that burdens me. Yeah? If there is a me there that is felt and known, then there's the problem of destination. Will there be other lives, you know? And what will happen at the end of when the body dies? You know what? That's stressful to think of. And if there is if there is no other life, it finishes. It's also stressful. I'm going to die. You know. But if with attention one realizes that every moment is gone, and nothing is owned really, then in a way there's the experience of death. Is from one moment to the next, you know. As you're walking and you step, these feelings here, these sensations here, and this knowing here, when you reach there, is gone. This experience of lifting the foot is not there when you're placing the foot down. This knowing of lifting is dead when you get to the knowing of placing. Do you see how much of a refined mind it takes to... And it's possible, you know, totally possible. But it takes a mind that is not caught into, I forgot to call Nicole, and when I go back, and stepping. You know, it takes a mind that has some settledness to see that, oh my God, intention arises, you sit here for some time. Well, one classic example is somebody's sitting and there's a cold that arises. And then there's the intention of, well, now it's heat, maybe. So the intention of unzipping might have felt very much like I'm unzipping. Nobody tells me to unzip, or you didn't instruct me to unzip. I unzipped, But it came out of conditions. There was some heat, sustained heat, and at some point, maybe there was like the intention arose to unzip. That's very interesting to see. Yeah. So anyway, these are just a few ideas around that, and. I like to think of one image that comes to mind for me is, like a tapestry with there's a woman playing the harp in the tapestry. You might have seen that tapestry. That's the classic one, the one. So we might think like, oh, there's a woman playing harp in there, But if you start to pull off the threads, see that the woman playing harp is completely enmeshed in the tapestry. She's not apart from the tapestry. And so, same thing for us here. We feel like I'm one of the people sitting here, or I'm one of us here. But the reality is that maybe, or another reality that is coexisting, is that I'm so not separate. Any part of me is not separated. It's conditional to the all rest of it. The accent, for example, it's not my accent. It comes out of a culture. Any intention that I've had in the last hour of sharing the Dharma and the wording is not personal. In a way, it is, because it's this amalgamation of humor and confusion and clarity and all this, but all these, they all are made of different things that, made of every encounter I had with my teachers and every moment of attention or this lack of attention and, so there's no separation per se. Wu Wei Wu says, 99% of our thoughts are about me, and there isn't one. No wonder we're stressed. Yeah? So, and this is the Buddha here. I am. This is a conceived idea. This I am. This is a conceived idea. I will be. This is a conceived idea. I will not be. This is a conceived idea. Conceived ideas are a disease, a boil, a dart. So, the two realities here is like, can I pick up the language? Like the Buddha was saying, like, oh, my, monks and nuns, the awakened ones that I hang out with, they use the language of I, but they know the limit of it. But we get mistaken. We use the language, but we're caught in the convention. We own things in our deluded mind. We are all of these things that arise and pass in our minds. And that's what we call delusion, and that's what we want to clarify, that these things really arise and pass. Clarity, ease, calm, you know, resentment, confusion really arise and pass. But they're not me. Not even the knowing of it is me. Anywhere where there would be appropriation, identification, the result will be suffering, stress. This is these teachings. So we have some job to do. Okay, so let's just sit for a minute in silence here. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. This is Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. And the Buddha, luminous is consciousness, brightly shining in its nature, but it becomes clouded by the attachments that visit it. And if it was not possible to free the heart from entanglement in greed, hatred, and fear, I would not teach you to do so. May we all find relief or release from the grasping to events and things and processes as I or mine. May we find a deep freedom that is unconventional.